The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
Good evening, 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 everybody. I've missed that laugh. How are you, Reedy Tlhabi?
I'm fantastic. I'm great, Bruce. How are you?
I'm exceptional, thank you. Well, I feel fine, thank you. How's life? You've just got a new show on television. You're hosting debates. You love it when people fight with each other. You love provoking the argument and finding a resolution by the end of it. But you're busy.
Yeah, Bruce, I am very busy. I am executive producer of The Big Debate and presenting it as well. I've done The Big Debate before. You know, it's such an intense town hall type of format show. And so we can't really produce it and present it throughout the year. So we come in seasons. So now the season has started. We've got more episodes than we've ever had. So I am busy and I'm moderating as well. So, that's what I've been busy with.
And I mean, doing The Big Debate in a time of COVID, of course, you've just got like 30 screens behind you while you're doing it. That must be an absolute nightmare. It's like trying to conduct a choir of three-year-olds.
You know, Bruce, the first two shows, I thought I was going to walk out. There was just no way we could control it. A virtual TV show is a big challenge. I really, really thought that live television in front of a live audience was the most difficult it gets. But virtual television, oh my word. And then it breaks and then someone forgets to switch their camera on and then the sound goes and then the lighting is not right. It's a long day when we record. Bruce?
No, absolutely. And I mean, it's hats off to you for tackling it in this time, because frankly, the debates are critical. We're in a really, really tough time in our country, in our economy, in our society, and the debates add an extraordinary amount of value. How are you feeling they're landing? I remember, you know, in your days on 702, you were just so frustrated by the politics. You were so sad about the politics of the country and where we were going. It was just before Jacob Zuma left office, of course, and we were in a really dark time. Do you feel like things are getting better in some small way?
I don't think so. I think because the damage wrought by those years that you just mentioned is manifesting right now. I mean, I've been following the ANC election manifesto and they continue to speak as if they're a party in opposition, as if they are observers of what has been going on under their watch in the last 27 years. So in a way, Bruce, I don't think that we can afford the luxury of separating those years that you described, the Zuma years, and where we are today, because somehow Zuma supporters think that there's no impact to decimating public institutions, decimating SARS, running the country's economy to the ground so that our tax base is shrinking and there's a bigger burden on taxpayers in South Africa. And by taxpayers, I mean not only middle to upper middle class people, but poor people pay VAT as well. Mm. They pay high transport costs and all of that. So all of us are carrying this load. So no, Bruce, I don't think that you can actually use the same leadership, minus, of course, Jacob Zuma and some of his supporters, but largely the same type of structural issues and cultural practices in the ANC. You can't pretend that those don't exist. So, no, I still feel the same way that I used to feel before. But I am encouraged when I see the progress that the SIU is making, some of the prosecutions in the air, not quite enough, but money is being retrieved. Perhaps it's not making such bold headlines as it should, but money is being retrieved, but it's not nearly enough. It's a fraction of what was stolen.
But the thing is, we just got to make the bad guys think twice. I mean, we're already 100 steps ahead of where we were 5 years ago. Sadly, bad guys don't think twice. They just act, as we saw in the PPE frauds. And that was, of course, deeply disappointing. Now, I mean, your story is well known. I mean, you grew up in Soweto. Your dad was murdered. Your mum brought you up. It was a tough upbringing, I think, for a young Reedy Dereko, as you were back then.
Bruce, it was a tough upbringing from that point of view, you know, losing a dad at age 9, especially in that kind of violent and traumatic way, unresolved murder and stuff like that. And also reflecting that there are so many like my dad whose deaths are unaccounted for. It wasn't political. It was an act of crime, we suspect. But at the same time, Bruce, I had a happy childhood. I really did. I had a very strong family unit, very present parents, and I think that made a hell of a lot of difference. I think that even when you grow up in trying circumstances, what happens at home does set the tone and determines whether you survive or you're prepared for the outside world or not. So yes, I do acknowledge those difficulties. I do know that I lived in Orlando East, where there was so much crime, there was so much poverty. But when you came from a family of nurses or teachers or doctors or priests, you did tend to fare better off than your counterparts. So from that point of view, at a societal level, yes, it was quite vexing and texting. At a personal loss with my dad, yeah, that was challenging. But I was given, I think, every tool available to go and chase my dreams, I think.
And I mean, you went to boarding school. You went to school in Potchefstroom, and you excelled. You went. It was Rao in those days, the University of Johannesburg, and then straight into journalism. And it's a career that many people don't stick around in long enough to hone their skills, simply because, you know, opportunities to really excel are fairly limited in a place like South Africa. But you grabbed multiple opportunities, a little stint in government for a while. You were a spokesperson in government. And did that cure you of any sort of desire to go and get a real job?
Absolutely, Bruce. Absolutely. And I think, oh my word, I always say I had a headache for a little while, and then I went to work in government, and I lasted literally, I started on the 1st of July and I resigned in August.
Really? Was it that short?
Yeah. No.
What was so awful?
I was asked, oh my word, Bruce, where do I begin? The first thing, the earliest memory of the sense that things are not all right was when there was a deliberate blurring of lines between what you do as a civil servant and what the AMC wants. Do you understand? So I'm meant to work for the government of the Western Cape as a communications manager and whatever. And then there will be party political things. And I remember there was a women's league in the Western Cape. They wanted money for an August 9th celebration. And the premier then, Ibrahim Rasool, I mean, he was naughty because he wanted to avoid them. And he threw me in that meeting. And I was like 2 weeks old in that job. And I sat there thinking, what the hell is going on? But it happened on numerous occasions, Bruce. And I just realized that this was not a space for me. I had no talent in that area of covering up and not telling the truth. But here's the one thing that was the straw that broke the camel's back. We went on an investment drive to London with the premier, and it was actually quite good. We were talking to businessmen and investors who wanted to invest in the call center industry. We were literally sailing the Western Cape. And I thought it was something positive. But when we returned, there was a story in the paper about how much money was spent on that trip. So I did my homework. And when the reporter phoned and asked, I gave her the numbers as they were.
Apparently, you mean facts? I wasn't supposed to do that. You're not meant to tell the truth. What's wrong with you?
So the next day, there's this meeting in the premier's office, and the chief of staff says, somebody is leaking information to the press. They've got all the numbers. No, I didn't leak it. I gave the journalist, and they all looked at me like, what the F have you done? I thought that's what we're supposed to do, communicate and tell the truth. So I just thought, this is a strange world. I've got to go back to journalism. I didn't last long at all. And I think, Bruce, hold on, before we move on, you have a lot to do with how the kind of journalist I became.
Don't blame me. Don't blame me for your hardigheid.
No. You gave me an internship many years ago when I was 20 years old, and you're so young. A slave driver. But here, I live to tell the tale.
Yeah, and the survivors have done very well. I was horrible. I was a terrible individual. I was completely out of my depth. I was 28 years old, put in charge of a newsroom of 50 people. Half the people were older than me. It was insane. But hey, we had fun. We most certainly did have fun.
I think it doesn't look like you didn't know what you were doing. It does not look like it at all.
Trust me.
We
didn't have a clue.
Tough for it.
Yeah, fake it till you make it. Now, listen, Reedy. You went into public service, you lasted 2 months. I mean, was there an attraction of money out of journalism and into a spokesperson's role at a provincial government level? Would have been a big leg up in terms of pay for you in those days.
You know what? I was lucky because the SABC took care of me. I was happy with what I was earning. And at those days, you could freelance within the SABC. So I was doing primetime news on SABC. And every time there was an election manifesto, inauguration, all sorts of things, I covered those. And that was extra income. So I didn't feel financial pressure. But what happened was I had an interview with our former president, Thabo Mbeki, and the powers that be were not happy that I challenged him on HIV/AIDS. I mean, how do you speak to a president of South Africa in 2004? Yeah. At the time that AIDS was literally hit us by the you know what, and you don't ask him that. So the boss of the SABC at that time was Nikki Zikalala. Let's just say nobody told me to my face that I had to leave, but certainly the environment was made quite uncomfortable. And I think it was an emotional decision. I'd never not worked in my life. I'd never felt unappreciated at any point in my life as a student, as an intern, as a reporter. I always felt that I had value and the people I worked with appreciated it. But that was the first time in my career where I felt the chills. And so I took the first job that came up, and the first job that came up was the government one.
Okay. And then you arrived at the newsroom at 7:02. And I once threw a ball of paper at Stephen Curtis, and that game stopped for a bit because I hit you on the head instead. And you gave me a look. You gave me a look. You were under pressure, I think, on the day that stopped for a bit. Now, listen, are you a responsible adult nowadays? You have two beautiful young daughters. You are married to a very handsome doctor. You live in a nice house in a nice suburb. You go running regularly. You're living well, but are you a responsible person when it comes to money?
Yeah. Bruce, I am. I am, but I wouldn't say that I'm conservative. I do save. I do make sure I have enough for what I need. But unlike some people who just like watching their money and looking at it and not spending it, I like to spoil myself. I am responsible, Bruce. I think because I was brought up by a nurse, a single mom. My mom provided enough, but there was not extra, if you know what I mean. You kind of were left in no doubt that if you have to repeat a year of university, you're going to pay for it yourself. We were not allowed to fail. So she made it clear that she was going to pay for the junior degree, the bachelor's degree and honors, but preferably we should be, you know, freelancing or working when we do our honors. And after that, that's that. And I saw her apply the rule so strictly to my older brother, who is a year and a half older than me and was always one grade or one standard ahead of me. So he went off to Wits Tech when I was in matric and didn't pass. And the following year, my mom was just not interested. I mean, he was going into his second year. My mom was not interested. He had to run around applying for this and that and that. And my mom felt, you haven't demonstrated that you deserve this. So that kind of scared me a bit. I knew she wasn't the kind of mom who'd threaten you with something and not follow through. She always followed through. So I've inherited that, you know, making sure there's enough money for what we need and wanting to provide for my children as well. So, yeah, I am responsible.
Do you still have a shoe habit? Because you I don't know if you still do. I mean, they don't get shown on Zoom calls, so therefore you could probably get away with fewer shoes. But there was a time where you and Katie Catapotis, I think, were in open shoe contestation.
Sure. You know what? I gave in because I don't think you can win a shoe competition against Katie Catapotis. But certainly, let's say I was her running mate. If it were an election, I would be her Kamala Harris and she'd be Joe Biden. I still love shoes, Bruce. I have a lot of shoes, a lot of shoes, a lot of shoes. And yeah, I can't wear them for Zoom meetings, but one day the sun will shine again and I'll wear my heels. I just love looking at them. You know, I just open my cupboard and I just look at them.
Do you have like an Imelda Marcos type problem with shoes? Or is there a limit? I mean, David Shapiro, the stockbroker, has got 250 ties, most of which he'd never wear again because they're out of fashion, but he can't bear to get rid of them. Do you have a shoe problem of that sort of scale?
Okay, I'll answer you this way. On several occasions, not recently, but on several occasions, I've come home with a brand new pair of shoes only to find that I already had the same pair of shoes.
No.
It's happened before, I promise
you. That's a problem.
And fortunately, the places from which I buy my shoes, they know me. I'm a familiar face. So I'd walk in and return the shoes. And there was one time, I remember it was Socrates Centen, one of the ladies who was helping me said, "No, man, I swear you bought these shoes 2 weeks ago." I said, "No, there's no way I would buy such an exquisite pair of shoe and forget." And I got home and I had the exact same color, same shoes, still in a box.
And you call yourself responsible.
So that's my answer. Get out of here.
Now, listen, are you going to run the Comrades again? Are you still as fit as you were 10 years ago? You do run a lot, but are you that serious about it?
No. You know, Bruce, I don't know. I think when COVID-19 ends and we all reflect on what we've lost, I do still run. So I will go out and do a 10. You used to tease me and say, oh, did you just jog the Comrades? And I'd give you the look then after running 89 kilometers. Bruce Whitfield comes to the office on Monday and says,
oh, you've been jogging.
Look, Bruce, you know, I think we lost a little bit of some of the things we used to do. And running is one of them. The races, the stuff. I find that the race, working towards a race, a marathon, an ultra marathon, that's my motivation. Look, I'm not so unfit that I can't get around. I run 3-4 times a week, 10Ks, 8Ks, but I'm certainly not as fit and as fast and as lean as I used to be a couple of years ago. But here's the thing with running, you can get it back. You just need to chip away at it every single day. So somebody actually asked me today if I was ever going to run the Comrades again. I had intended not to because I've had multiple running injuries, but they're getting better. And now the idea of being in the startup, in the lineup next year as I attempt my 7th medal, it's really, I'm salivating thinking about it. So I thought
You've
I was done.
You've done it six times. I thought you were smart. I thought you learned your lessons as you went along. What does the future hold? Everyone's curious about Reedy Tlhabi. You are a presence on our screens. You're a presence on stages. Well, you will be again. Your presence, certainly very vocal presence in social media. How are you feeling about the future?
I'm anxious about it, Bruce. I'm anxious about our crime levels. I'm anxious about youth unemployment in South Africa, because these are not issues. These are not news issues. These have a direct impact on our future as families. It has a direct impact on the quality of education that we can provide for our children. So I think I'm like a lot of South Africans who feel that there ought to be something better, whether here or there, whatever. But there ought to be something better, because I don't want my children to inherit this kind of anxiety that I'm feeling. And I am feeling a bit anxious about those things.
Are you investing in their education? I mean, you are able to. It would be insane not to. The public education system in South Africa betrays hundreds of thousands of kids every single year.
Bruce, you know, yes, I am investing in their education, but their dad must carry the load.
And of course. But when I say you, I mean as a family. I mean, he's got to do something, hasn't he? Yeah.
Okay. So that's his department. Yeah, that's his department. But absolutely, Bruce. I mean, they are pupils at a local private school here, and I'm unapologetic about it. I think that a lot of us do pay our dues to the public service, but it is not always accessible, and that's a disappointment. And my kids go to private schools, and I do. We want to create an environment where they can study anywhere in the world if that's what they desire. And I will spend every cent to make that happen.
And that's the thing. I mean, and that's the great crisis of the future of South Africa, is so many people are giving up on our local institutions. They just don't see a future for them. And I think that's tragic.
Yeah. And I also don't think we need to obfuscate or be politically correct. I know that there are a lot of people who carry guilt because you don't want to trash your country. But I have no such burden. I don't think that I owe fidelity to kind of a PR existence. When something is bad, it is bad. The health system as well. I have personal experience in the last couple of years of people close to me who have needed serious healthcare service. And I know, for example, I've tweeted about losing a friend to cancer last year. I just know a couple of other people. My mom had a brain tumor in 2017. I mean, when I left 702, I was going to go overseas, do a fellowship for a while. That didn't happen because of that. I just know, Bruce, that if our specialists are superb, they are world class, they are peerless, it's not the quality of the care once you are in the hands of a specialist. It is the process, the step to get to that point where you are seen by one of our amazing doctors. And then it is the cost of the medicine as well. I just know that a whole lot of my loved ones would not be here today had they not had private medical aid care and extra to pay for the gaps.
And yeah, and the cost of living in South Africa is high. The cost, the level of inflation is high, the real inflation rate, yeah. Not the CPI levels, simply because we do live in a global village and the rand is not what it should be and the economy is not what it should be. But Reedy, listen, I'm going to let you go and have some nice supper with your lovely husband. Hopefully your girl's already in bed because you're a strict disciplinarian, no doubt. And I wish you...
at 8, yeah.
Oh, well, you better go put them to bed then. Thank you for joining us, Reedy Tlhabi. It's been lovely to have you on the radio. Thank you for sharing some tales with us, and it's lovely to catch up. Reedy Tlhabi, everybody. Good night, good night, good night, Reedy Tlhabi.